Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of your weekly Handgun World podcast. Episode number 318. I'm Bob Main, your host. I carry a gun because I can't carry a cop. This week, I've got another interview for you. Glenn Tate, the author of the book series on prepping and survival, and also a little bit on guns. The book series is called 299 Days. It's a 10-book series, been out there a long time. I know a lot of you listening read the books, but I'll bet some of you don't. And you need to. Check it out. If you're going to get Glenn's books, go to www.handgunworld.com. Go to my Amazon store, buy it through my Amazon store, and you can help support my show. So Glenn came back, and I wanted to get him back here after he was finished writing everything. That was one of my goals, is that I wanted to talk to him and chit-chat and ask him some questions about what life is like post-book series. And he had a lot of really cool things to say, so I'm not going to steal any of that. You'll hear about that shortly. But a really neat voicemail came in from a listener that I want to address. So let's listen to his voicemail, and I'll be right back.
Hi, Bob. John out here in Washington. Hey, I've got a bunch of questions for you. First off, I'm wondering if you have seen or tried the new Ruger LC9 Pro with the light trigger pull. I hear nothing but good things about it. And then I heard your comments about the RMR sights. And I guess what's been holding me back a lot is the price and also kind of the size. And I'm wondering if you have any insight on when the prices are going to come down a little further or what we should pay for one. And then I'm wondering if you've heard at all whether there's any mainline manufacturers that are going to build an RMR sight right into the gun. It seems like that would save a lot of space and be more efficient, sort of like some of them building in the lasers. Finally, I'm wondering about registering my new guns with the manufacturer. They ask you to do this so they can stay in touch for recalls and what have you. But it seems to me if the government's having trouble finding guns, one of the first places they're going to go to is to the manufacturers to get their records. So I'm wondering if you register your guns with the manufacturer or not, and what your advice on that would be. Lots of questions, but thanks, Bob. Bye-bye.
John, thank you for the voicemail. I'm going to get to all your questions in just a little bit here. If you are a listener and you're interested in calling into my show and asking a question or a comment, or even if you want to beat me up on something, I don't care. Hey, I don't have all the answers to everything, so if you want to set me straight, let it rip. The telephone number is area code 210-646-1727. 210-646-1727, or you can go straight to my website, handgunworld.com, and there's also a call me button. Either of those would work. I like voicemails, but if you don't want to be on the air, I understand. Just please tell me that. Otherwise, I assume that you do. So, John, the LC9, the Ruger LC9S Pro. When you called, I had never played around with one of those guns. So here's what I did. I'm on a trip right now. In fact, I'm in the Handgun World mobile studio. And I decided on the way home that I would stop by a gun shop that I knew and that I would find a Ruger LC9S Pro, which is a single-stack 9mm by Ruger. It's the latest version of their LC9. And I figured that I would mess around with it and dry fire it and manipulate it, rack the slide, so on and so forth. So I found a gun shop. The first place I stopped at had one, so that was really cool. And in fact, I was impressed with the gun. I really was. You know, I was never impressed with the LC9, the very first one, the very first version that came out. And I think I actually covered that on an older podcast, but I have not fired live rounds through this gun, so I am going to give not a full review, but just somewhat a review of what I have been able to discern from messing around with one at a gun shop. What a vastly improved trigger from the original LC9. I do think that it still has way too much take-up and too long of a reset. I'm talking about the LC9S Pro. But the break is very nice, and it's a much better trigger. The trigger was something I never liked on the original LC9 anyway. The whole action system and trigger is just not my cup of tea. But the LC9S Pro striker fired, I could see myself carrying and owning one of those. I don't really have a need for yet another single stack 9mm, but if you're a listener and you don't have a single stack 9mm or you want to get another one, give the LC9S Pro a really good, serious look. The dealer's price was only $419. I think you can actually, if you shop around, do a little bit better than that. But I'm a big fan of supporting local gun shop dealers whenever possible. You know what? If it's a difference of $20 or $25, I'm going to buy it from the local dealer. I'm going to support the local dealer. You know, these guys are in a tough business. Being an FFL, being a gun shop dealer, it's not an easy business. And it's a place I can go back to if I have issues with the gun. You know, some dealers will treat you a little bit nicer, give you special prices if you buy several guns from them. So, you know, over the course of time. So I like to build rapport and I like to support the local gun shop. So I would definitely pick it up if I was in the market for it, probably at that price. The other thing is I love the feel of that gun. It feels very, very nice in the hand. The bore axis is not too high. You know, for those of you who don't know what I'm talking about, the bore axis, basically meaning the bore of the gun, right down the middle of the barrel. How low does that sit in your hand? I'm a big believer that lower is better. The lower that sits in your hand, the better off you're going to be able to control recoil, make faster follow-up shots, and being able to shoot that gun effectively. It's one reason why I like Glock pistols and M&P pistols a lot, is because of the low bore axis. Other guns out there, they sit pretty high in the hand. This Ruger LC9S Pro did not. Very nice sights on the gun. The one that I handled did not have a thumb safety either. Now, I haven't looked it up. I don't know if this is a regular feature of the Ruger LC9S Pro. Or if that was just a version without a thumb safety. But that's the one I'd buy. You know me. I'm not a big fan of thumb safeties. If it's going to be a carry gun, that's what I'm going to buy. So if all of the LC9S Pros don't have thumb safeties, then whoa, congratulations, Ruger. Nice, nice, nice. Now, I hope I'm not upsetting all you 1911 fans because, you know, I've been over this ad nauseum. I'm not going to waste much time on this episode doing it. You can go back and you can listen to older episodes. And I did a complete one-year test switching between Striker Fire and 1911. And I put out a few episodes on along the way and my progress on it and so forth. So I'd encourage you to go back and listen to some of those old episodes. But I got to say, I was fairly impressed with the gun. And it seemed like a pretty well-built gun, but the feel of it was nice. No thumb safety. Very rounded corners. That's something else I really like. That really helps in carrying. You know, nice rounded corners that helps in and out of the holster. Makes it, I think, a little bit smoother, sometimes a little bit faster. And it prevents the gun from getting snagged on clothing. If you're going to pocket carry that thing, it prevents it from getting snagged in the pocket. Just a really cool gun. Not very big, not very heavy. Definitely one to consider for a single stack 9mm. If you don't want to get the brand new Glock 43 or the Smith & Wesson M&P Shield, which so far I still think is the best single stack 9mm pistol on the market today. The Smith & Wesson M&P Shield in 9mm. That's just my opinion. Now, I got more to say about that a little bit later in this episode. We'll see. That may change. It may not. But I got to tell you, nothing wrong with this Ruger pistol that I handled in the gun shop. So good question, John. Now, you also asked me a question about RMRs, Trijicon RMRs. You asked, you said one of the things that's holding you back is the price. I understand. When I was on Paul Lathrop's Polite Society podcast, that question came up. And, of course, I replayed in a recent episode that interview. And we talked about RMR pistols. You know, the price is what it is. I don't think, John, that it's going to come down anytime soon because they're just worth it. Those RMRs are worth it, especially the Trijicon. And most people who are red dot aficionados on pistols, most of them recommend the Trijicon RMR. There are others. There are Leupold, and Leupold makes a really nice version of it. Burris Fastfire makes a less expensive, and from what I heard, pretty good. I think, John, it's worth the money. If you have the money. And some people say, well, Bob, you know what? For the price of the RMR and the cost to mount it, I can buy a whole nother gun. Yeah, you can. You can buy another gun. But you have to assess what's more important. Going out and buying another gun that you have to now train yourself to use and give a 1,000-round trigger job and run a couple hundred rounds of your carry ammo through it to make sure it's reliable enough for self-defense. You can do that. Or you can take your tried-and-true Glock pistol, M&P pistol. Those are the two most popular. You can take your tried-and-true gun that you have given a 1,000-round trigger job to, that you have run a couple hundred rounds of your concealed carry ammo, and it's proven reliable, and you can shoot it well, and you can spend that money that you would otherwise use to purchase another gun, and you can get a Trijicon RMR red dot sight. I would get the 6.5 MOA, but that's just me. I would get that red dot instead of the 3 MOA. Everybody's a little bit different, but that's kind of my preference. You can do that. And now you don't have to worry about, well, gee, do I know how to use this gun? And what's the manual of arms of it? And blah, 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 blah. You now have a really cool setup. Do I own one? Not yet. Will I probably own one by the end of the year? Yes. One of my Glock 19s before the end of the year is going to go to Suarez International and get a Trijicon RMR on it. And that's most likely going to be the very next thing that I'm budgeting for. Okay. John asked about size. I have seen a lot of people that come to training classes at the range, just generally at the range. I have seen lots of people conceal a pistol with an RMR. And while it's concealed, I sure can't tell that it has an RMR. Most of the time I couldn't even tell they were carrying a gun. But if I could tell they were carrying a gun, I surely could not tell that they had a gun with a Trijicon RMR red dot on top of it. You ever notice that? How many of you have noticed somebody carrying a gun? If you're an experienced gun carrier, you'll notice. But here's my next question. How many of you have noticed what kind of gun they're carrying? Ah, a little more difficult, isn't it? So I don't think it really hurts concealment at all, John. And I think that's a moot point. Now, you brought up a really good question when you asked, are the manufacturers going to build the RMR into the gun like they do with lasers? Well, I'm not connected enough to the gun industry, the firearms manufacturing industry. I'm not connected enough to know that yet. I guess I'm not one of the big guys, you know? There's a lot of really big guys out there and industry pros, and I'm just some Joe Schmo everyday guy that messes around on the side teaching people how to shoot a little bit better because I got a lot of training under my belt. And, you know, I put out this podcast. I've only been doing it for 5 years and several thousand people every month and things like that. But I'm still not one of the big guys. Yeah, I'd like to. I'd like. You know what? Can you help me with something if you're listening? Can you spread the word on this show and see if you can get some more people to listen? I'd like to be one of the bigger guys. I'd like to be one of the more higher influential industry professionals if I could do that, if I could achieve such prominence. You know, folks, that's not why I do this show. I've mentioned that many times. It's not why. This show is about my journey and about what I learn, what I see, what I witness, what happens out there. And then I hit the record button on this little Sony MP3 player and I start talking about it. Or I interview somebody about it and I bring that information to you. And if you benefit from it, woohoo, that's good stuff. If you don't benefit from it, well, then hit the stop button or the pause button and don't listen to me again. Or go to the next podcast that has something a little bit more interest for you. So, John, I don't know. I don't know if the manufacturers are going to build them. In other words, put the guns out with an RMR on it. What they are doing is many manufacturers are getting on board with manufacturing guns that are already, the slide is already cut and drilled for a red dot. Glock is doing it, and M&P is doing it for sure. Smith & Wesson and Glock are doing it for sure. Smith & Wesson has been doing it for a while with their Core series, C-O-R-E, and I'm pretty sure, God, I'm going to screw this up. I think that's Combat Optics Ready Equipment is what that stands for. And Glock calls it the MOE, and I have no idea what in the world MOE stands for. But anyway, some of their models do come out of the box from the factory, drilled and ready to mount your favorite, or almost one of your favorite, almost all of the different types of Trijicon, all the different kinds of RMR, red dot optics that you can put on a pistol. I mean, like the Smith & Wesson M&P, I'm pretty sure there's four or five different brands that you can put on there. Again, I've mentioned I am a huge fan of the work that the folks at One Source Tactical at Suarez International do because they've been doing it a long time. And Gabe and his team, they got it down, man. They got it down. They've been doing it a long time. They figured out what works. They figured out what doesn't work. So check on that, onesourcetactical.com or Suarez International. Okay, John, you asked another question in your voicemail about should you register guns with the manufacturer? In other words, should you fill out that little card that where the manufacturer wants you to put down all the information, your name and your address, serial number of the gun, bunch of questions and things like that. You know, I used to do that, and I don't anymore. I was going to say I want the least amount of people knowing what I own as possible. And then what do? Once a week I get on this podcast and I tell thousands of people about what I have. So I guess that's kind of counterproductive, isn't it? But, John, I can see where you're coming from. I would, you know what, but I think a lot of manufacturers use that for marketing. And I just don't want to be inundated with marketing, with ads and emails and phone calls and things like that. So I don't do that anymore. You know, does it help to keep up with recalls? Come on, whenever a manufacturer has a recall, the whole world knows about it in 24 hours. With the internet age and, you know, everybody's carrying smartphones these days and has internet access, the world knows about it now. So, you know, don't buy into the argument if a manufacturer says, well, we want your information so that we can keep you up to date about recalls. What they really want to do is they really want to market some more to you, and I wouldn't do that from that simple fact. Should you look at it as, well, if the government wants to find out who's got guns, yeah, I guess that's plausible. That's plausible. I don't go tinfoil hat on people, and I'm not really a big tinfoil hatter. You know what? We got worse problems than the little information card that you filled out and sent to the manufacturer. You know, if the government is going to come after our guns, I think that would be a really, really interesting and tragic time in America. But the government is going to bully people into finding it out anyway, and there's a lot of ways they can find it out. Now, I know some people love to buy all of their guns from private citizens in states that allow private sales, maybe go to a gun show, or, you know, maybe go on some kind of an internet site where that facilitates a lot of private sales, and all that stuff might be a lot more untraceable, and you're probably right. And so if you wish to obtain your firearms that way, you probably should. But I don't think filling out that little card registration, that's not really something I would do, and I just explained why I wouldn't do that. So good voicemail, John. Thank you very much. Lots of good questions in there. Lots of topics that I think that other people are wondering about as well. Okay, just a real quick break, and Glenn Tate will be on this episode.
80% of all homicides are gang and drug trafficking related, according to the Bureau of Justice Statistics. That means at least 80% of all firearm homicides are caused by gangs in the drug trade. Not you, not your neighbor, despite what Dianne Feinstein might think. On average, gang members arrested for murder are often suspects in two other homicides. These two items together show that 80% of gun homicides could be stopped by incarcerating as few as 3,000 well-known repeat violent offenders. That's who Feinstein should be working against, not you. Arm yourself with facts to strip the gun control industry bare. Visit gunfacts.info and get your free copy of Gun Facts. Called Indispensable by Cam Edwards of NRA News, Gun Facts is your rapid reference guide to debunking gun control myths and shaming politicians into obedience. www.gunfacts.info.
During the break, I got to tell you that I bought a Glock 43. Yeah, I did. I did. I know on Facebook and on the podcast I talked about when they first hit, like 2 days after they hit the market, I received a phone call, and you know, there was an ungodly price, and I was offered a special deal, but I wanted the gun shop owner, because I support local gun shops, I wanted him to make the extra money on some poor sap that just had to get his Glock 43 right now, as soon as they came out. I want one right now, man. And I got $640 in my pocket, and I'm going to give it to you. Give me one of them Glock 43s. And I thought, yeah, okay, that guy, I got plenty of guns, and if that guy wants to shell out his money, I was not going to do that. But now, I got a Glock 43 at a reasonable typical Glock price. Yeah, I think the prices are already starting to come down to typical Glock prices. So I'm now the proud owner of a Glock 43. Haven't shot it yet. Going to be doing that. Hopefully I'm going to shoot it this weekend. Well, maybe by the time you hear this podcast, I will have already shot it. I'm recording this podcast on Thursday, the 30th of April. I might get a chance to shoot that this coming Saturday. Anyway, I like it. I tell you, my initial impressions of the Glock 43, it's really not as big as people say. I have a Glock 42, and I held the 43 and the 42 up side by side. I flipped them actually upside down, put them on my desk, took the magazines out of both of them. That's important. You should do that when you're comparing size. Take the magazines out, because you know, Glock, shipping the Glock 43 with that magazine extension and all that. Take it out of there. Hold it up to a Glock 42 with no magazine. You're going to find something out I didn't know. It's like a quarter of an inch difference in length. That's it. Between the length of the grip on the Glock 43 versus the Glock 42. A quarter of an inch. Maybe 3/8 of an inch. That's nothing. That is nothing when it comes to concealment. I'm talking about with no magazines in a gun. Now, the barrel length is really not that much longer on the Glock 43. It really isn't. The width, to me, looks absolutely identical. And if it's different, there's very little difference that I can tell with the naked eye without getting some calipers out and measuring it, which I didn't do. So the Glock 43 is not that much bigger. than the Glock 42. It is a little bit too big to pocket carry, I'll say that. The Glock 42 is very pocketable, especially in my DeSantis Superfly pocket holster made for guns of that size. Plenty of other good pocket holster makers out there. The Glock 43, not so much. The Glock 43 is going to be either an inside the waistband or outside the waistband. And it's also significantly larger than any kind of a pocket 380 or anything like that, which you would hope and you would think so. So I'll let you know after I have a chance to shoot it. My only disappointment on the Glock 43, and it wasn't enough to keep me from buying one, was that the magazines only hold 6 rounds, but I'm sure real soon now, somebody like, probably Pierce, is going to make a 1 or a 2 round, or maybe both, magazine extension, so that you can put 7 rounds in the magazine and have a place to put your pinky on the grip. I mean, surely they will. They've done it for every other Glock out there. I sure hope that they do it for the Glock 43, and they probably will. Maybe even Glock will do it eventually, like they've done with some of their other guns, make a Glock factory plus 2 extension like I've got for my Glock 26. So I'm not all that worried about the lower capacity. It's a single stack 9mm. That's one of the sacrifices you make. However, I said earlier in the podcast, I still think the 9mm shield is the best single stack 9mm you can get. And I know I'm a big Car PM9 fan. Love my Car PM9. I'm carrying my Car PM9 right now. So my Car PM9 will always be a gun that I have, and a gun that I shoot a lot, and a gun that I carry. I don't think the Glock 43 is, right now, I'm going to say, I don't think it's better than my Shield 9mm, but time will tell, and after I have a chance to shoot it and really put it through its paces, then I'll report back to you as to what I find. Okay, before I bring Glenn Tate on, I want to remind you about some classes that Ben and I have coming up. There's still some time to get involved in the Sioux Falls, South Dakota Beyond Concealed Carry Enhanced 2-day class. There are a couple of spots. If you're a last minute, or hurry up and get signed up for that. We are going to Ohio. All of you Ohio listeners, you've been emailing for a long time wanting us to do a class. Here we come in September. And then Chaz from the Road Gunner podcast and Tracy Thronberg, a lady who does a lot of training in Austin, one of Austin's best trainers. They're going to team up with, the two of them are going to team up with me and with Ben. And in November here in San Antonio, we are teaching Level 2 Beyond Concealed Carry Advanced. Last but not least, we're going to the state of Washington in August. More about that coming later. Please become a member of our Shooters Club. We'd love to have you as a member of our Shooters Club, where you can watch really cool videos, 25 or 30 videos that Ben and I have produced. Just the two of us have produced it. You'll see some footage from our classes. You'll see some that's not, some that's more staged, but we're demonstrating things and evaluating things and all that. Really good stuff. Ways that you can support our show. The Shooters Club's only $75 a year or $8 a month. All right, let's get to Glenn Tate. Well, my guest for this episode, Glenn Tate, is back. Welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you, Bob. I'm glad to be here.
Well, you know what? Likewise. And I just wanted to bring you back because I've got just some general firearms questions and a couple of prepping questions and things. But before I get into that, what is it like now post-book series now? What are you doing? How's it going?
No one's asked me that question. It's a fantastic question. The answer is, I've got so much time on my hands, I had no idea how much time I spent. This is going to sound stupid to everybody listening to this, but anyway, I had no idea how much time I spent writing and editing and working on, you know, all the other aspects of the book. In fact, 10 minutes ago, before I walked in the door and talked to you, I was thinking about, there's an event that came up today that came up a year ago, obviously in 2014, and I was comparing what life was like in 2014 versus 2015 and how I was just consumed by this book and all these other aspects of it. And now I have time to, I don't know, I'm going running with my wife and
we're like
going on dates and going to a concert and stuff and living a somewhat normal life. And so that's been pretty cool. I was just in the middle of it. You know how it is when you're doing something, especially when it's a big activity that's really important to you. You're just in the moment and you're doing things and getting them done. And then you step back and you say, oh my goodness, that was a lot of work. So I've been having fun is the short answer to your question.
Well, I am glad to hear that. And for people that don't know what Glenn and I are talking about, in case you're a new listener, Glenn's the author of a book series consisting of 10 books. The series is titled 299 Days, and each of the books are its own kind of own little miniature subject. You know, I mean, Glenn writes about survival. He writes about preparedness. He writes about economic collapse and things like that. But you don't go all wacky with it. It's very common sense, which is what I like. I'm glad you wrote them that way.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm a common sense guy. You're a common sense guy. And I think most people, the vast majority of people who are preppers, gun owners, are common sense people. And I didn't like all the stuff about 99% of the population's killed and there's cannibalism and zombies and all that stuff because, I don't know, I'm a pretty concrete person. I mean, things have to be concrete for me to believe it and buy into it. I'm a lawyer. I look at evidence. That's what I do all day long. And yeah. I evaluate factual things. And so the reality of 299 days has really struck a chord, quite honestly, with a whole bunch of people because it's, first of all, believable. I think really, really believable. Oh, by the way, I need to pause for a moment. One of the little storylines in book one is that Democrat state auditor in Washington State would have some legal troubles, and last week the Democrat state auditor of Washington State was indicted.
Oh, so you were right on
that 4 years ago, and I didn't even have this particular state auditor in mind. And it's not like poor Chicago where everybody gets indicted if they're in public office. So it was actually a big prediction. And anyway, I digress. But the books are pretty factual, so that's good. First of all, because people can believe them, but second of all, they're great for persuading people who aren't preppers, who are on the fence, reluctant spouses, those sorts of people. Because you start talking about cannibalism, I kind of quit listening because that's just weird. And there's none of that. So anyway, yeah, that's I think what you're getting at.
Well, nice prediction. That was great. That was great. Well, and people need to know you're also a gun guy, and so I want to talk about some firearms. Now, you know, we right now we're kind of just starting probably the largest firearms release in the history of the firearms industry probably right now. And I use the word we, but I should use the word Glock. Glock's 43, model 43, I think is probably going to go down when it's all said and done as the biggest launch in history. What do you think?
Oh, absolutely. I'm not a hype guy, and I'm not a Glock fanboy, although I'm a big believer in Glock. I was thinking of it this way. You know, when sliced bread came out, it was actually a really big deal. It was legitimately a big deal, hence the phrase, greatest thing since sliced bread. I think the Glock 43 is the sliced bread of the gun world, and it's going to be amazing. I have a Glock 42, which I love. The size of it, I mean, I have to be low signature, and I can't carry in a lot of environments, and I need something I can put in my truck console, locked by the way, in my truck console, and I can pop on a belt and pop off a belt. I have a Concealment Solutions prototype holster that's fantastic, and the Glock 42 fits right in it. It works with everything that I wear. I know I just sounded like a woman there, but I mean, it works with everything I wear, and it's easy on and off. Well, you take that same size, roughly the same size, and instead of 380, you go up to 9mm, and it's a dream come true. It's all you can want. And by the way, there are other great small single stack nines out there. I'm not saying there aren't, but I I can't wait, and it's going to be interesting to try to get one of these things. I have friends in the military and law enforcement world, especially the law enforcement world, and they're used to getting any kind of pistol they want anytime. I mean, they have to pay for them usually, but I mean, they go to the front of the line. You know, SWAT team guys kind of go to the front of the line.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're being told months and months of waiting for these things. So, it'll be interesting when they actually kind of flow out to you and me, but, I can't wait. And by the way, I'm going to keep that Glock 42. And if anyone out there, you know, thinks their Glock 42 is no good and it's only worth $100 trade in, let me know and I'll buy all the Glock 42s through FFLs, I might add, that I can, because those are still great guns.
Yeah, they are. I'll do the same thing. Whatever you don't buy, I'll buy. You know, I kind of made a mistake, I think, probably a week ago. When I heard a few weeks back that the Glock 43 was coming out around the NRA show, I got a hold of Ben at Sparks Firearms, Ben Branham, and I said, put me on the list. And I didn't know I was the number one guy on the waiting list. So, yeah, so about a week ago when it came in, the owner of the gun dealership called me up and said, Bob, your Glock 43 is in. And I'm like, ooh, all right. And he said, now I'll warn you, he said, I'm going to make a special deal for you, but these things are selling on the internet for over $600. And I almost fell off my chair. And I told him, I said, you know what? I said, I have plenty that are serving me well. Why don't you sell it to somebody that can't wait and sell it for over $600? And thank you for the special price, but I'll wait.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah, well, yeah, you say good for me, but, you know, then again, these things might be, you know, hard to find, and so now who knows how long my wait could be. My wait could be, I could be interviewing you this same time next year and still waiting on my Glock 43. But,
well, don't worry, the Glock 43 magazines are only $600 a piece. No, I'm just kidding.
Yes, my Glock 42 is going nowhere now that it works fine. And I want to say this, I want to encourage people to listen to Ben Branham's recent review on the Glock 43, because he actually got a chance to shoot one shortly after they came out, and he's got mixed reviews. But, yeah, that's, so, what else is going on firearms-wise?
Well, I think the big thing everybody's been experiencing is the ammunition scare, you know, number 942 or whatever.
Yeah.
With the M855, which, you know, obviously instantly all the M855 went away. And then, of course, for good measure, all ball, you know, 556 and 223, you know, seem to go also. I guess it's slowly coming back. But, boy, how many more ammunition scares can we absorb? I mean, this is just getting out of hand. I mean, prices start to fall again, and then there's a big scare. So, I don't know. That's a big deal. 22 is obviously still hard to get. I have quite a lot of 5.56 and 22 that I got a while ago, so I just continue to do my recreational shooting with that stuff. But, I mean, that's I guess, my question for everybody is, you know, how many more ammunition scares can we you know, weather? It was funny, I was speaking yesterday with my friend at an ammunition supply company, and I asked him how these scares, you know, affect things, and he said what I thought he would say, and he said capitalism is an amazing thing. There are all kinds of small loading companies, you know, maybe they're dormant when there's not much of a demand, and maybe they're, and he, these are my words, not his, maybe they're almost hobbyists, you know, they have like really big reloading capabilities for an individual, but small reloading capabilities for, you know, a company sort of thing. And then those little batches are getting out there, and when the price is right. So I guess capitalism is working. The thing that capitalism doesn't take into account are political goofy things that the politicians do that then artificially, you know, spike demand, or in some cases artificially, you know, reduce supply. But anyway, so I guess the market's working, but I wish it wasn't like this. I look back at the good old days, you know, 2007, 2008, when you just get all the ammunition you wanted anytime. We used to buy boxes, right? 50-round boxes of ammunition instead of like, oh my goodness, I need a case of this and a case of that. But anyway, that's what I'm noticing.
Well, you know, you bring up a good point, and I'm glad you talked about ammunition, because I've said this before many times. You know, the people that are anti-gun, that want to control what, you know, gun owners do, ammunition is their target. You know, it's pretty difficult to ban a gun or a gun part, but all you got to do is put some restrictions on ammunition, and it really limits the capability to what gun owners can do.
Yeah, and you don't just need to do it regulatorily. You can let the market do it for you. I mean, you have a little regulation, the M855 ban, which then creates a big market run, and the leftists that want to take away guns that hate free markets must be laughing, because they're using the market to get what they want. So that kind of bugs me. But yeah, no, ammunition is the key, and there are some ammunitions, as you know, 22 long rifle being a good example, that you can't reload. I mean, not really reload, and so that's a problem. And then, of course, the bad guys will just go after reloading components, and that's the way of taking care of that. So yeah, it is a big problem, which is one of the reasons that a lot of people are buying by the case right now.
Yeah, you should be, and buy now. The supply seems to be more plentiful. You know, I was at my favorite local gun shop here in San Antonio, and they had plenty of 22, good quality 22 ammo in stock, and I picked some up. So buy now and stock up, because you never know when all this ammunition and magazine craziness is going to happen again.
Yeah, the neat thing about ammunition is it's not like it has an expiration date. It's not like cheese. It doesn't go bad.
Right.
And, you know, you can just store it forever and ever and ever. I have some 5.45x39 that was, you know, made in the early 70s, and it works just fine. So there's, you know, there's no expiration date. And the price of ammunition, as a practical matter, never really goes down. I mean, it might go down a little bit, but, I mean, it's an asset. It has value. It can be used. It doesn't spoil. It could save your life. You know, and I know I should invest a bunch of money in gold and silver, and I haven't. I've been investing in a bunch of other things, tangible things, prepping things. But I put my sort of fun money, my gold and silver, you know, money into copper jacketed lead, and I view ammunition very, very seriously. I'm not kidding, as a precious metal, as a commodity, and so that's what I've been doing. And when you think of it that way, because it's a legitimate way to think of ammunition, when you think of it that way, it makes the financial side of spending money on ammunition, it makes that flow a lot better. And I think it's a rational investment.
Yeah. I mean, it's not the kind of precious metal that could pay some dividends like silver and gold. However, it's the kind of precious metal that is not going to go down in value, certainly, and can save your life. You know, plus, I think about stink hit the fan times. Ammunition could be a very good bartering tool for people that didn't stock up.
Absolutely, and all those common calibers. I mean, I have more 12-gauge, you know, 7.5-ounce birdshot stuff than I could ever possibly use, because everybody and their dog has a 12-gauge, as I talk about in the books. All those grandpa's 12-gauge that got dusty sitting in a closet somewhere was getting dusted off, and everybody has 38 caliber revolvers, and everybody has 22s, and, you know.
And 9mm.
And 9mm, exactly. So, I think of that. I have, as I say, way more 12-gauge and way more 38 than I'll ever use, but it is for bartering.
Yeah, for bartering purposes. Hey, Glenn, I wanted to ask you something else. Refresh my memory. Is open carry legal in Washington?
Yes, it is.
Okay. All right. That's the big buzz here in Texas right now, because it looks like any day now the legislature is going to push open carry to the governor's desk for his signature in Texas. And what do you think of that? I mean, we've had a little bit of discussion about open carry in the past, but what's your feeling on open carry?
Well, I start at this question and let people know that I'm a political person. I don't run for office because elected officials are, by and large, scummy, and I have no patience for that. I just want to say political. I mean, persuading people and trying to get people to agree with you, and I don't really mean, you know, vote for me stuff, but I want to persuade people to be liberty-loving and to be tolerant of gun people like me. Remember, I live in one of the most liberal places in the United States of America, the state capital of Washington State, Olympia, which is near Seattle, and this is a government town here being the state capital. I mean, you live in Texas, you know about Austin. Olympia is like the Austin of Seattle. I mean, it can, like, have liberalism, like, to the second power, like square root material. But I live in a place where it's extremely uncool to be like I am. But I want to persuade people, as I say, to be tolerant of gun owners. Obviously, open carry, you know, we have a constitutional right to it. It's a good thing. I open carry on rare occasions when it sort of makes sense. I don't go out of my way to open carry, but I'm not afraid to open carry. And so I think that open carry should be legal everywhere. And I also think that people should use some judgment and, I don't know, I mean, not go to a Starbucks with an AR-15. I mean, it's a weird thing. Usually I'm pretty black and white and, you know, clear on things, but you should be able to do it, but I think it's a bad idea to do it. And now I'm talking mostly rifles. Open carry of pistols doesn't really bother me that much. You know what's funny? You know, speaking of Starbucks, on one of the Valentine's Day, Second Amendment days that they had a few years ago where people were encouraged to go to Starbucks, open carry, and very politely thank the management for Starbucks' policy of honoring local laws, including open carry laws, I did it. And I dressed up in my business attire, and given how I look in my business attire, and I had a Glock 17 in a Raven concealment holster,
yeah,
I think everyone assumed I was an FBI agent because I look like an FBI agent. And so it wasn't weird. I think me being in a Starbucks carrying a pistol probably, you know, calmed people. They probably thought, oh, isn't that nice that the Secret Service is here or something like that. But so I don't cause the bad reaction in people. But there are some folks, let's be honest. I mean, you know, show up with an AR-15, as I say, at a Starbucks, and you're gonna freak some people out. And I don't think that makes people more tolerant of guns. I think it scares them. So that's a weird, somewhat inconsistent position of it should be legal, but don't do it. I mean, actually, as a libertarian, there are a lot of things that I think should be legal, but people ought not to do. So maybe it isn't inconsistent. Maybe it is consistent.
Well, I've never discouraged somebody from open carrying. I've always said that I probably won't do it, maybe just a tad bit in certain places, but people need to have the right to. The thing about open carry, which is interesting, especially here in Texas, for a very long time, open carry of long guns have been legal here in Texas for a very, very long time, but not handguns. But so many people make open carry a political statement rather than the fact that they just choose to open carry. And that's, you know, and that's what can, and I say not always, but it can lead to difficulties is when it becomes a political statement.
Exactly. And here's a way I was thinking of it, and speak just mostly now talking about open carry of pistols. If you're going to open carry a pistol and let's say you're at the grocery store and you're helping little old ladies carry their sacks of groceries out to their car, and I mean, you're just being a model awesome person, everybody thinks, wow, that's a great person, you know, and oh, by the way, that person happens to have a pistol on his or her belt. That to me is great because you're persuading people, you're being a good example. And that would be great. But if you have neck tattoos and, you know, 7 piercings in your ears and you have an AR-15 and you go to a Whole Foods, you're going to absolutely terrify those people.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, depending on what kind of a degradation our society goes into, and again, I'm not an extremist or a tinfoil hattist, but I think that one of almost all your books, you know, you write about the degradation of society. I think you might see more open carrying if that ever happens.
Oh, absolutely. And I don't think that there will be a light bulb that goes on and all of a sudden, you know, it's apocalyptic conditions. There will be at least a few weeks of degradation, and you're going to see more and more open carry where it's legal. And I think that when crime is completely out of control and normal people, people who've never thought about these things, they're not. There you go. So I was saying that you brought up the point that when stink hits the fan, maybe open carry will be welcomed and people won't be as afraid of it. And I think that's true, especially, again, depending on who's doing the open carrying. But I think there will be a couple weeks, perhaps, I don't really know, of skyrocketing crime. It could be a couple months, could be a couple years, but at a minimum, a couple weeks of skyrocketing crime. And I think that a lot of normal, nice suburbanites who have never thought about violence or guns or anything like that will be reassured when they go up to the grocery store, again, that example I was using, and there's somebody who's open carrying and they're a decent, upstanding citizen. I think that will be reassuring. I guess what I'm saying is in these peaceful times, these very prosperous times, all these, you know, I don't know, weenies who are afraid of guns, they sort of have the luxury. It's a weird use of that term, but they have the luxury of being afraid of guns and being scared of everything and having the superior elitist attitude that guns are for redneck hillbillies. And that all works in the current situation, but when your neighbor got carjacked and your other neighbor, there was a home invasion, and this all happens in a couple day period, all of a sudden, even brainwashed liberals are going to have a hard time hating guns and fearing guns again when decent, upstanding people are carrying guns. So that'll be interesting. And I talk about that some in the book, how they're changing attitudes and how some people, their attitudes about guns and violence in general, just turned on a dime because all of a sudden the situation was different. And so, yeah, we could see that, and who knows, it could be a permanent good change.
I like your reference to some of the anti-gun liberals as weenies. I like that. That's good. I may have to borrow that one from you, Glenn. Hey, here's something I've been meaning to ask you for a while. I don't know if I've ever asked you in an interview on my show. If someone were to come up to you and say, hey, Glenn, you know what? I know that you know a lot about firearms, and certainly you know a great deal about survival and prepping. But, man, you know what? I don't have a lot of money, and I'm kind of on a budget. And I really only have enough saved up to go out and get one firearm. That's it. It's about all I can handle. What would you advise them to check into?
I think a good quality handgun, obviously semi-automatic pistol, and there are all kinds of good ones, Glocks, Smith & Wesson, SIG, they're all good. And that's what I would do because it's concealable. And for most folks, and I assume that most people live in either an urban or suburban setting, the uses for a firearm that we're talking about is relatively short range. If you live out in Wyoming, well, first of all, you've already got 50 guns if you live out in Wyoming, so you don't need one. But if you're talking about Wyoming and your driveway is 4 miles long, then maybe a precision long-range rifle is a good idea. But the one gun I think should be a pistol, concealable, short range, and that sort of thing. And, yeah, that's where I'd come down on that one.
Yeah. Probably something like a good quality 9mm and a common caliber, maybe a .45 handgun that, like you said, could easily be concealed and more than adequate for self-defense purposes.
Yeah, exactly. When I have friends that ask me this question, and that's what I answer, and then I go to – we have a big Cabela's, regional size Cabela's, and – go there and they try out all the handguns and find one that fits. That's one thing you've championed since probably episode one, and that is be sure that you try guns to the extent you can and make sure it fits your hand and it's comfortable and the weight's good and all of those other things. Preferably go rent one and shoot one, but people need to do that. And that's where I come out and quite a few of my friends, some of whom are characters in the book, by the way, I won't tell you which ones, but they have a good pistol and 1,000 rounds of ammunition, at least 5 magazines. I always tell them 10 is even better. And they know how to use it, and they go out, and they don't shoot as much as I'd like them to, but it's not one of these things where it's still got the price tag on it.
Yeah.
And, people say, okay, now I'm ready for anything. And so that, I think, is the way to go. And then, of course, you know, shotguns are good. AR-15s are wonderful. AKs are great. All those sorts of things. But really, most people, you start talking about, oh, you need to go get an AK-47, they kind of look at you like you're a little weird. So I like to break them in a little bit and get them comfortable with the pistol, get their family comfortable with the pistol. And then I take them out shooting, and I hand them an AK or an AR or something like that, especially with a red dot sight of some kind. And I say, yeah, go have some fun. It's funny, the real Governor Ben Trenton from the books, real guy, I took him out for first time, and I handed him, after he worked on the pistol that he bought and got good at that, I handed him an AK-74 with an aim point, and we were at 25 yards, and there was a little rock about the size of an egg. And I said, see that rock? He said, yeah. And I said, put that red dot on that rock. And he did, first time he'd ever fired a rifle, and he vaporized the rock. He
did it
25
nice.
Yards. And he looked at me and said, that is so cool. And I said, exactly. So anyway, that.
Very nice. Yeah, that's awesome. So my hypothetical question is actually reality for you.
Yeah, because a lot of people ask me this. The people who know a little bit about me, the characters in the book that are real life people, which are about 90% of the characters in the book are real life people, especially the ones that you see over and over again, Ben Trenton being an example. They ask me these things, and we talk about it. And, so yeah, people come to me. I can't say that people that don't know me very well come and ask me this, because they have no idea, you know, that I do this, or that I know about this, or that I've,
right,
let alone that I've written 10 books about it. And so, which is how I like it. I kind of blend in, and my neighbors, for example, both of my neighbors have no idea. They just think I'm this nice, normal suburban guy, and that's the way I want to keep it.
Same here. And unless people know me personally, that very few of them know exactly what I do on the side outside of my real job.
Mm-hmm.
And I like to keep it that way as well. Getting back to something earlier that you said, that I think I would like to expand a little bit more on, is, you know, a lot of people are just one gun families. I think we have a lot of that in America, where, you know, after Sandy Hook, they thought, well, I need to go get me a gun. And then they come to you and they say, hey, Glenn, can you teach me how to fire this and use it? But that's about as far as it ever goes. And I think there are a lot of those types of families in America. Would you agree?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, when you started describing the scenario, I thought of a couple of my friends who, after Sandy Hook, came to me and said, I need a pistol. And I went out with them and got them a pistol, taught them how to shoot. And I think there's a bunch of those people. The statistics are interesting. There are all these gun owners out there, and then you look at the number of guns, and it's usually there's a bunch of one, maybe two gun families, but a ton of one gun families. And then there's people like you and me that have a bunch of guns that skew the average, right?
Yeah. We make the numbers go up, and some of the other people that are listening, because I tell you what, there are some listeners to this show that have a whole lot more than I do, and we do kind of skew the numbers. But I think there are a lot of just one-gun families, and I'd throw a suggestion out there. If you are one of those one-gun families listening to this, make sure that everybody in your family who is of age and eligible knows how to shoot and use it.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, think of this. Think of the horror and the regret you'd have the rest of your life if you didn't want to rock the boat. And I'll use a typical example of a man that has a gun, and his wife, you know, thinks they're icky, and he doesn't want to deal with the friction and the heartache and the drama about trying to get her to go out shooting. So he's going to take the easy route. And then something bad happens, you as a man can't, for whatever reason, place the shot, can't hold the gun, you're injured, blah, blah, blah. And it's up to your wife, and then, you know, she doesn't know how to shoot, and you have to watch in slow motion as something bad happens. So that ought to motivate a whole lot of people. It's kind of like it's a variation of the character Todd and Chloe in book 8 and what happens with them, and that whole regret and that slow motion is a really big deal, because I think there's going to be quite a bit of that regret that goes on. And so just deal with it. It's unpleasant, the whole convincing your spouse of things. Believe me, I've lived it. We've talked about that. Book 1 is 97% true, and it's a lot of it's about that. And so I know what I'm talking about. I'm not some guy who's just saying, oh, yeah, you know, just tell your wife, you know, that it's going to be your way or the highway, because it doesn't work for me. I mean, I'd love to get on this podcast and make everyone think that it worked for me, but it most certainly does not. But, yeah, that's just something that you need to do. And I would put kids in the category, too. I'm lucky that my kids, especially my daughter, who's just, you know, amazing with firearms and absolutely loves them, that's a great thing. Especially, if I may be candid, it's really important, I think, for young ladies because they they attract more bad guys. And they need to be able to take care of themselves, both in an equipment sense and being a firearm, and then also the training sense and the mental sense. You know, it's a hard thing for nice people to have to think about using force to stop somebody from hurting them, but they need to. And my daughter is a great example of a very nice, wonderful, bubbly person who, you know, would need to if it came up, and I think would be able to mentally, sort of morally, be able to put down a threat. And that's one of the things I was thinking about as I wrote that scene in one of the books. I won't give away too much, in which the character, who's my daughter, had to do something like that. And the repercussions, by the way. It was a horrible, yucky thing and created nightmares and all of that, so it wasn't glamorous. But anyway, I'm drifting a little bit off of your topic, but yeah,
sorry.
Family needs to know. And I'll tell you, older folks need to know too, because if for no other reason as a practical matter, older folks are home, right, all day
right.
long.
Right.
And they often run into home invasions and all these other things. Think of all the news stories and everything you hear about armed conflict, you know, homeowner defends self. It's just an overwhelming number of the people who defend themselves are 79 years old or something like that. So they run into these situations more than younger people, and they need to know, you know, too, and need to not be afraid to use these things. Sometimes you need to have special considerations. Sometimes recoil, if you have arthritis or something like that, might be an issue, but just help them through that. And it's a great way to hang out with grandma or grandpa. Let's go out to the range and, you know, shoot our 5.7 or something like that. You know, it's a great older person gun, right? 30-round magazine. Yeah, that's a good time.
Yeah, you mean what, the FN 5.7?
Yeah.
Oh, you know, I've shot that thing. I've had a chance to shoot an entire 20-round magazine through that. That's a dream to shoot.
Oh, it's a beaut. I mean, it is. There's just no recoil. It's amazing. There's also that Kel-Tec in 22 Magnum, the model number of which I forget, which I've not shot, but it's probably
PMR 30, isn't it?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, 30, because that's the number of rounds in the magazine,
yeah.
Which I've always thought of that, especially the 22 Magnum caliber, as a good gun for older people or people who have arthritis or something like that. So yeah, everybody needs to know how to use it. I mean, if you can train your dog to shoot, you should probably do that too.
Yeah, if you can figure out a way to do that, yeah. Well, and people take that lightly, and you know, you really mentioned a very radical idea earlier, and that's getting your kids to shoot. Oh my God, what are you? You some kind of a nutbag or something, or what?
Well, it's funny you mentioned that very point, because I have an aunt who is of the extreme left-wing persuasion. And a few years ago, I put up on Facebook a picture of my daughter, then age, I don't know, 11 or something like that, shooting a bolt-action 17 HMR. Not exactly the most deadly weapon in the world. Not a scary-looking gun. It's a hunting kind of gun. It's a precision target gun. It's got the thumb hole stock and everything. It's a really cool gun. But it wasn't exactly an AK.
Yeah.
And that picture, I mean, I still hear about it from my aunt. You know, it's like, oh, yes, your daughter, she's, you know, you're putting up pictures of her on Facebook with a gun. It's like, I don't really talk to my aunt that much. But, but I mean, there's something about, you know, kids and guns. You couldn't possibly teach them how to shoot, could you? Oh, my goodness. And, I mean, I'll tell you, you ought to see my daughter shoot. And here's the other neat thing, and this applies to both my kids. Some of our best hangout, you know, parent-child time has been shooting. I mean, my daughter and I in particular have had amazing conversations out there on the range.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, we were and another cool thing. Oh, this is a great story. We were shooting at the Real Joe Tantori's range and with some federal law enforcement guys, and my daughter shows up, and she's a teenager, and she has like a pink scarf on. It was cold out, and pink gloves, and I could tell they were being nice and stuff, but they thought, you know, oh, this is cute. You know, I'm sure that, you know, dad's just like, you know, babysitting this teenage girl. And so we were talking, and I said to her name in the book, so I'll use her book name is Manda. I said, okay, Manda, let's go AK-74. I said, now, you know how to open up a spam can of 5.45, don't you? And she took the spam can and the can opener and opened up the ammo can and started loading magazines of 5.45 and then racked the thing, you know, put the magazine in, racked it, started advancing and was hitting the steel the whole time.
Nice.
You know, it was just, and these agents were just shocked. But anyway, that's kind of cool. That's a dad bragging point right there. I'm going to be very honest.
Yeah. Well, and you're right. It is a wonderful family activity. And some of the best memories I had, we were big hunters when I was a kid, were some of the best memories were carrying shotguns out there and hunting pheasants and grouse and ducks and things with my mom and stepdad.
Yeah. Yeah. You never forget it. And it's just a great thing to do. And there's no downside to it because obviously you and me and everybody probably listening, we're all safe and everything. So that's not an issue. So you take that off the table and everything's good.
Yeah. Well, good. Glenn, thanks. You know, it sounds like your post-book life is going pretty good.
Yeah, no, it's been terrific. I still get all kinds of emails and Facebook messages from readers, and they tell me amazing things, how the books, you know, help them or help them with their spouse and getting people on board. And so I still get all kind of that good stuff from it, and that's a lot of fun. And it's been a blessing. And as I mentioned before, the coolest thing about the entire book is what I call the Cool Friends Project. I mean, and you're an example of that. I listened to your podcast, you know, really from episode one, and then fast forward a couple years, and then you have me on the show, and you've had me on the show quite a few times. I mean, you know, we talk, and I mean, we're going to do a class here coming up, and all these cool things that have come out of it. And so it's like all these just amazing friends and acquaintances I have. That's been the coolest part of the whole book.
Yeah, and it is, and that's the thing. Me too, even doing this podcast, all the cool friends and acquaintances that I make, people like you and many, many others. And you mentioned a class we're going to be doing. Last year we did this class at the Real Joe Tantori's range, and we're going to be doing it again almost the same day. It's like I want to say, I think it's August 7th and 8th or 8th and 9th. People can go to the website and check it out. But you're going to be there again with probably one or two members of the team, right?
Absolutely, yeah. And it's an amazing place. I mean, you described it last year. It's beautiful. It's in Western Washington. It's on the ocean. It's on an inlet, actually. And it's an amazing classroom, the bunkhouse. The range is great. Joe is amazing, and he's a real guy. And I mean, you can look at how I describe him in the book and how he really is, and it's pretty amazing. It's a really, really great time. There's something about that place where you spend a few hours at his range and his compound, I guess you'd call it, and you just kind of get refreshed and renewed. And you also noted this, the pictures of the various classes that are up on the wall, there's pretty interesting people who come out there and train. And
some we can't talk about, but you're right.
Yeah, people who need to blur out their faces in a good way when they're photographed. So it's a pretty legitimate facility and really good time and great instruction. And the weather is amazing in Western Washington in August. I mean, you cannot beat it. There are no bugs, no humidity, no snakes. I mean, we got it made in August. I mean, it rains a bunch of the other year, but in August, you just can't go wrong.
Yeah, I got to say something, reinforce what you said about this range. You know, like you said, some pretty serious high-level people have trained at this range. People we really can't, you know, Joe has asked us to not even mention what we see there, but you know, the thing is, that really creates a good class when there is a venue like this, even with a bunkhouse that'll sleep 14 or 15 people right on the range. So anybody that signs up, if you're in one of the first 14 or 15 people, you don't even have to pay for lodging, and it's a 75-yard walk to the range. That really makes for a good class.
Yeah, everybody's together, and you're you know, proximity-wise, and there's something about that bunkhouse. I mean, the team goes out there pretty frequently, and we've had amazing conversations and amazing times. There's something about that bunkhouse that just brings out this, I don't know, cool experience. I mean, people should try to experience it if they can, and you'll understand what we're talking about. And the students that we had out last time who were listening to this are nodding their heads right now.
Yep, they are. They're nodding their heads. Glenn Tate, thanks for coming back on the show. I very much appreciate that. And let's not let so much time pass next time.
Yeah, sounds good. Sounds good, Bob. We'll talk soon.
All right, good luck. And if you, folks, if you want to get his book or any of his 10 books, go to handgunworld.com, use my Amazon link, and then just Google or just search on Amazon 299 days, and you'll see them all on there. Thanks for your time, Glenn.
Thank you, Bob.
Take care. Well, many thanks to Glenn Tate. His book series is fantastic. I'm sure he is nicely reaping the rewards, and he deserves it. So, Glenn, I know you're listening. Thank you again, and we will see you and a couple members of the team at our training class in early August at Fort Discovery. I hope those of you listening, I hope some of you are going to be there. It's already started. Sign-ups started several months ago. And there will be a sellout point of the class. And I can tell you we're not there yet, but we're going to be. And if I had a crystal ball to figure out exactly when, I would let you know, but I don't. I would just say don't procrastinate. So go over to handgunworld.com and find that class. You know what? If you don't want to spend any extra money, but you like what I do on this show, remember, I don't have any sponsors. Everything I've mentioned on this show, everything, is simply products that I either have used, have trained people using them, or products that are sent to me for evaluation. Nobody sponsors the Handgun World podcast. So you get my objective opinion every single time. We're all under budgets, and we all have limited amounts of funds. So if you don't want to spend any extra money, but you still want to say, hey, I'd like to support Bob and what he does, make your Amazon purchases on my Amazon store. You're going to buy the stuff anyway, so it's not like you're spending extra. You've made a decision to buy something off of Amazon. Go to www.handgunworld.com and go to my Amazon store. It's there on my website. And buy your products through my Amazon store. And let Amazon pay me for you doing that. And that helps support the show. Thanks for listening, folks. As always, I appreciate you very much. This has been another episode of the Handgun World Podcast. I'm Bob Main. I carry a gun because I can't carry a cop. And remember that the loudest sound that a shooter hears is a bang when he's expecting a click, or a click when he's expecting a bang. Shoot straight and shoot safe. Talk to you next time. Goodbye.